welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, your weekly cybersecurity news and threat research podcast that's brought to you by the ReliaQuest threat research team. My name is Chris, and I'll be your host this week. And I'm very happy to be joined by two of my colleagues from the Threat Hunt team. So first up, we have Colin Ferris, who's joining me very early from Vegas. Thanks very much for joining, Colin. How are you?
Thanks for having me. Brain's still booting up a little bit, you know, 7:40 in the morning over here.
That is incredibly early. It's middle of the afternoon here, and my brain's still booting up. So fair play to you for joining at this time. I've already had two cups of coffee in the lead up to this podcast, but there we go. And also from Vegas, we have, fair enough. We also have Caroline joining us from Vegas too. How are you, Caroline?
Hi, good morning. On the same wavelength, I have my coffee ready to go.
What's the coffee houses like in Sin City? How is it? They must have some fabulous places, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. I feel like nothing is like Northeast coffee, though, but that's just me. I'm a little biased.
That's fair enough. I usually get stuff from like African brand coffee, you know, origin coffee, I should say, usually my favorite. But no milk this week. I'm just having it straight up black. So it's really, really quite bitter. But there we go. It's keeping my brain in check. So, right. Let's get cracking with this week's podcast. So I think the best place to start is the same place that we started the last 2 weeks. And of course, that relates to the exploitation of the zero-day vulnerability affecting file transfer provider MOVEit. And as we clarified last week, the exploitation of this vulnerability has been attributed to the Clop ransomware gang, who've made quite the habit of targeting similar zero-day vulnerabilities in file transfer software. So you might remember that Clop conducted similar attacks against Excellion's FTA, which is a legacy application. I think that was last year, if I'm not mistaken. Might be 2021, actually. Anyway, quite a while ago. And also GoAnywhere's MFT secure file sharing solution as well. That was earlier this year. And I think the first thing I'd like to say really is just it just highlights the agility and resourcefulness of these kind of extortion actors in 2023. Yes, ransomware is an enormous problem. And of course, the majority of these groups copy each other, very much kind of monkey see, monkey does. But there are divergences in the tactics that these groups use. So Clop has repeatedly demonstrated success in both identifying and exploiting bugs in these types of solutions. And I don't want to sound like I'm kind of fanboying, you know, this activity, because of course it's really, really serious. But just to highlight that the nexus of these kind of extortion actors in the modern day isn't black and white. You know, it does kind of come in murky flavors as well. Obviously what Clop has done is kind of different to the majority of ransomware activity. So on the 14th of June, which was yesterday, we started to see Clop naming victims to their data leak site. And at the time of recording, I say yesterday, it's actually the 16th, isn't it? Because we're recording this on a Friday. On Friday, the 16th of June, 2023, I believe the number stands at 27 companies who've been named onto Clop's data leak site. And of course, this number is likely to swell in the coming weeks. So just a question to you both, Colin and Caroline, just, you know, checking your thoughts on this one. You know, how busy have you been with this incident?
This activity was released across our entire customer base. And then for basically starting with profiling whether the actual application was in use, and then followed by indicators of compromise and evidence of data transfer. We definitely have had several true positive hits. I know one of the things that was very interesting to us as we started our investigation was that there were several cases where the web shell was dropped onto the impacted MOVEit server, but there was no evidence of data transfer. So it looks like, which is interesting considering how apt that Clop is at automating 0 days, that the payload being executed isn't automatically built to start data exfil in any shape or form.
That is super interesting. So it's almost like they either didn't get round to it yet, or you know, it didn't perform in the way that it was expected. They probably simultaneously impacted by this. Must be enormous. So perhaps it was just a case of, you know, didn't get round to it at that stage, or otherwise the control kind of stopped that activity. Super, super interesting. And any thoughts from you on this one, Caroline? You've been busy with this?
I myself have worked one of those investigations where we saw that web shell being dropped and there wasn't any exfil. It was definitely really interesting for me to work that incident. And just to come to that conclusion that we have regarding those web shells, and like just to see, to like compare that to what we know about co-op and how they operate as well, has been really interesting for our team.
Good stuff. A lot of lessons learned, I'm sure. I think we just end with this particular section of the podcast just by talking about, you know, what companies kind of need to do. You know, general, we have released a series of blogs on this particular incident. So the most recent of these went on the 14th of June. I think it was either 14th or the 15th of June, basically summarizing, you know, what we know so far, what you should do. I would say that, you know, from my perspective, you know, organizations just really need to evaluate the files that are stored on their MOVEit solutions and any third party MOVEit servers, you know, inquire with vendors about any possible exposures, and really just take a risk assessment on the possible sensitivity of, you know, active data. And if you use a susceptible version of this MOVEit software, you know, your incident response team should really just assume that data has been compromised and kind of start that IR process. You know, just kind of expect the worst, and then, you know, you'll be in a better position if that worst does happen. I will also say that, you know, obviously negotiating with criminals if you are impacted is an extremely high risk approach. And obviously, even if a ransom's paid, there's no guarantee that the data will not be breached or otherwise sold onto interesting third parties. You know, these are criminals at the end of the day, and their word can't be trusted. And just that any decision you make, kind of sounds like a bit of an egg sucking exercise, this one, if you've ever heard that British phrase. But basically, I said that one to my American colleague a while back, and they're like, what are you talking about? Sounds like an obvious thing to say, but, you know, senior leadership, you know, board, public relations, and I guess for some industries, regulators should all be part of the decisions on how to proceed, you know, if you are impacted by this and kind of CLOP comes calling. If you don't use MOVEit, then I think it's also prudent to take a risk assessment of other file transfer software that's being used, given that CLOP will probably target similar solutions in the future. You know, we've seen that with the two I mentioned before, so Go Anywhere and Anywhere, you know, whatever that might be, you know, restricting public access to authorized users, set up your firewall rules, you know, obviously apply the software patches, although in this case, appreciate, you know, the horse is kind of bolted, but, you know, making sure that you have your VM process down to a T. And then given that CLOP also regularly target 0 days, I guess it's essential just to point out that logging, you know, is in place to identify any suspicious activity with those logs collated in your. Okay, so we'll move on to the first kind of big item of this week's podcast, I guess, beyond CLOP, and that's related to Gootloader. So in the coming weeks, we'll be releasing a blog based on Gootloader, which is a stealthy malware classified as a first stage downloader that's designed to attack Windows-based systems. It is considered a kind of initial access as a service tool. It's commonly used by a number of sort of different threat groups, but notably ransomware groups like the one we just kind of mentioned. So Caroline, given that you're the author of this piece, could you provide our listeners with a background on Gootloader in general and what your blog contains?
Yeah, sure. So I won't go too in depth to spoil the blog because I still want y'all to go read it. But so first of all, Gootloader is a JavaScript-based initial access malware strain, as Chris was mentioning, meaning this is what the threat actor will use to initially just get initially get access to the environment, usually not interactively, but they use this to enable the infiltration of remote access payloads in order to eventually engage with that target interactively. So the delivery method for this particular malware strain typically occurs via search engine optimization poisoning. And it's also been recently known to target the healthcare and legal industries. SEO poisoning is just a way for attackers to basically push their compromised website or page to the top of your search results within whatever search engine you're using. And this is just because usually users are going to trust the results that they get towards the top of their results page on Google. And with regards to the targets recently that have been known in the healthcare and legal industries, just a simple question that anybody in those industries like might type into Google, are pages that are going to be targeted for those for hosting that payload on. So for example, the one that we worked this time, the user had put in the question, what is the difference between, I believe it was, what was the difference between legal ruled and some other different type of paper? And that was the question that they put into Google. They got results. I think it was maybe the second or third result that came up on Google was our Gootloader page. And that just presented with a super common, I guess, template that Gootloader is known to leverage for those compromised sites. They kind of look like a fake forum, and it'll have somebody asking the same question that you asked at the top of the forum. Typically, some user by the name of admin answering with a link to whatever the answer to your question is. And if you really want to know the answer, you give that thing a click and you download that initial zip file. And then you start the infection chain there. And it's, I would say, the usual second stage payload that has been seen the most is Cobalt Strike, just due to just how popular that is. But as with our incident, we can see that that can vary a little as well.
Interesting. That's so specific as well, the example you gave. What was it again? A legal document.
There's all of the questions are very specific. So just simple questions like, what are the lease agreement requirements in, let's say, Pennsylvania? Like, somebody will type that question in. A forum page with somebody asking the same question comes up with a link to that zip file. But yeah, yep, all pretty specific. The pages like rotate pretty frequently, just so they can make sure that they have the most questions, I guess, covered. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
that is really
my biggest takeaway.
Go on, Colin.
Oh, sorry. I was like, my biggest takeaway is definitely the old trust but verify. If you see admin activity, just because it's an admin, don't just assume outright that this is legitimate.
You see admin and you automatically trust it. I like that. I guess because it's so specific, I don't know, I'm kind of thinking, because it's such a specific question, maybe my guard would be down, because I'm thinking, well, no one else is probably asking this from a malicious perspective. I wouldn't expect it. So it's a really ingenious way they've got of kind of spreading this malware. What did we identify as the best way to minimize a risk from Gootloader and kind of similar malware, other than not asking specific questions on Google that you anticipate are going to be bad? What could you do to kind of stop the risk from Gootloader?
Yeah, sure. So the biggest way that we definitely recommend for all of our customers, and this also like goes beyond Gootloader, this goes for anything that starts out with a JavaScript based file. So for example, you can configure a GPO with an Active Directory to change the default execution engine of JavaScript files from WScript to Notepad. So anytime anybody downloads that zip file, extracts it, and then tries to run that JavaScript file, it's just going to open with Notepad and it's not going to execute on the machine. So that's a pretty surefire way to make sure that doesn't get executed.
Fabulous. There we go. I think that's quite a common control, right? So hopefully most of our listeners will have that kind of control in place already. But if you don't, then that's definitely a surefire way to start. Fabulous. Let's pivot again. We started with Klopp exploiting a vulnerability, and then we went on to initial access malware. Let's pivot back to vulnerabilities and talk about a new Fortinet vulnerability. So essentially this last week, Fortinet have released new FortiGate firmware update. Pre-authentication remote code execution vulnerability in SSL VPN devices. So these security fixes were released on Friday. So I'm going to very quickly open my calendar. So presumably that's Friday the 9th of June. In Fort iOS firmware versions, and there's a number on there to read them all out, to be honest. But essentially, this is another kind of big vulnerability that's got security researchers kind of concerned. So the CVE number is CV2023-27997. So I'm going to aim this one towards you, Colin. What specifically does this particular bug allow a threat actor to accomplish?
Yeah, so, at high level, this is a remote code execution RCE vulnerability. It's accomplished via a heap overflow bug. So essentially, this is basically memory exploitation. And on successful exploit, the attacker is going to be able to run whatever code they wish on the impacted device. And this could be really anything from like simple commands or entire in-memory execution of malware. So it's really just, the sky's the limit in terms of what you're able to do once you have that successful exploit.
What's the risk right now? Is there kind of like proof of concepts available? Have we seen any kind of active exploitation? What have we sort of seen for this particular bug?
So far as I've been able to find, there are no published POCs. This was originally discovered by the team over at Lexfo and disclosed to Fortinet, and they're withholding POCs or even additional information for red teamers. They discovered it during a red teaming engagement until a later date. However, Fortinet has reported that this has been exploited in the wild, and it was added to CISA's known exploited vulnerability database on June 13th. So this either implies, we have confirmed evidence of past exploitation, but this could also imply active ongoing exploitation. There's just not a lot of information regarding that. Particularly also like on victimology. So we don't know impacted organizations. Looking through technical documentation, it doesn't seem to be a relatively trivial POC. So the thought at this point is sort of if you're impacted, you were specifically targeted. However, like I said, given that lack of information and the low complexity for the actual exploitation, given, high impact. So, you have RCE at that point. We typically recommend like this, treating this with as much organization or as much urgency as your organization can manage.
Good stuff. I did read that Fortinet were kind of releasing details of this or patches to, customers ahead of actually, making the vulnerability public, giving organizations, I guess, the best opportunity to sort of put themselves in the right place, before this was made public. So presumably before, bad actors are actually able to create these POCs. Other than patching, is there anything, I guess that's the first thing you would say, but what should listeners be actually doing with regards to this particular bug?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I'll definitely, recommend if you have a Fortinet appliance, to go to the official website and review the actual documentation provided by Fortinet for mitigations and remediation. But just the recommendation at this point is just to upgrade to the latest version and disabling SSL VPN. So it's a relatively simple fix, but again, disabling your VPN might not actually be a viable solution for a lot of organizations. So there's also documentation on hardening of the FortiOS. I highly recommend that you take this into account. There are a lot of issues arise when you just deploy and never take the appropriate steps to do best practice and harden the actual thing that you're deploying. Some agnostic recommendations, for any network appliances, just always maintain a frequent scheduling for patching and updates, regardless of the actual device. If it's public facing, it's going to be scanned and it's going to be attempted to be exploited. Like, we see this all day, every single day. And for VPN specifically, we really recommend enabling MFA and device certificates. The biggest thing with that is even if you have leaked credentials out there on the web, if you have device certificates in MFA, that's going to really mitigate the potential for initial access via those compromised credentials. I think the last bit here, I was just going to add a little thing for investigation. There is some IOCs out there right now related to basically exploitation has seen the addition of some super admin root accounts basically named either FortiGate tech support or Fortinet tech support. But given this is RDCE, like this isn't a guarantee. It's really just up to the threat actor's imagination, as I said earlier. So anything anomalous, whether it's process executions, network connections, et cetera, this is heap-based exploitation. So there is a possibility of crashing the actual appliance, the process handling these VPN connections. So anything like /bin/SSL/VPN-D in your process crash logs could be indicative of exploitation. And there's also some, the exploit is against these two URLs, post and get requests for remote/host check validate or remote/login check. This is going to be likely a quick succession of, you know, rapid request against these endpoints to sort of build that overflow, but it's not guaranteed. You can build it out over time. So, but those are just some potential telemetry to look for in the event that you think you might be impacted.
Excellent. You've left me lost for words at this point because you've just given such amazing advice at a high level and in the weeds sort of perspective. But no, some fantastic advice there. Thank you, Colin. Really, really good. Yeah. Let's just get on top of it, I guess. And before it's exploited, it's only a matter of time, I suppose. Get it patched. And take all those other mitigating factors I just mentioned as well. Let's move on to the last aspect of this week's podcast, which is related to recent reporting of a group of Ukrainian hackers known as the Cyber Anarchy Squad, who've claimed an attack that took down Russian telecom provider Infotel on Thursday evening, it says. So Thursday, that would be last week, so the 8th of June. And among other things, the Moscow-based telecommunications provider provide connectivity services between the Russian center and other Russian banks, online stores, and credit institutions. And following the attack, reportedly multiple major banks across Russia had their access cut from the country's banking systems, so they could obviously make no online payments, which is a big deal, I imagine. A really, really kind of successful attack, I guess, in the grand scheme of things for this group of Ukrainian attackers. So the question to you both, whoever wants to answer first, of course, what exactly, you know, did occur? You know, how did this group of attackers actually achieve their goal of taking down this telco? And what might the sort of residual impact be?
You know, I think starting with the residual impact, that Ukraine has taken a very proactive stance in terms of advocating for and publishing any sort of activity, offensive operations against Russia, and asking for basically volunteers to join this sort of effort. So in terms of impact, you know, like you said, multiple banking systems down affects economy, and Russia's economy has definitely been impacted overall since the start of this war. So money talks, and money is what makes decisions. So anything you can address hitting those sort of aspects will impact a cascading impact across every industry, every individual is affected. In terms of the actual details, I'm not too familiar in how the systems, but I know that, like, I think there was down for 34 hours, 24 plus hours. That's a very, very, very long time for operations down.
That's enormous.
Yeah. Which is both a testament. It's that testament to the offensive operation against this telecom, considering, you know, this is a Russian based telecom who probably has backing from Russia government as itself. So being able to take down such a massive infrastructure is a testament to their operations, or is indicative of potential lapses in security controls and infrastructure, maintaining infrastructure by these organizations. I know we've seen within the actual war itself that the world's wider view of the actual military prowess was misplaced in a lot of ways. So this could also apply to infrastructure related to telecommunications in Russia. So the time will tell as we as these operations increase in probably severity, whether there'll be other impacts.
That is a super interesting way of looking at it. So essentially, when the war started, we kind of all assumed within the intelligence community that, you know, this would be over very quickly. But obviously, Ukraine put up incredibly stubborn resistance and obviously backed by the West in financial and other ways. But we all kind of took a back step, didn't we? And said, like, what on earth is going on? Like, you know, do you remember the long convoy of trucks like going into Ukraine targeting Kyiv? And we all sort of looked at the Russian military and gone, is this a paper tiger? And I wonder if you could draw, like you say, the same comparison with, you know, what's happening from their controls in major institutions. Like, it might be lacking. But like you say, 36 hours?
34 hours is what I've read. So that's an enormously long time for
long enough, I would say, for the Russian perspective, at least. That is incredible. I mean, listeners are going to learn something about me now. My first job in this industry was working for a telco based in the UK. And I can tell you, if we had a DDoS attack that resulted in a matter of a few hours of downtime, like, that was seriously big news. Serious, serious problem. So 36 hours or 34 hours rather is massive. So yeah, that was an incredible success for this cyber anarchy squad. Next question, I guess, is just, you know, what are the motivations of the group? I guess this is a really obvious one to answer, but is this hacktivism or is this something else?
I mean, this definitely seems like hacktivism, but a slightly like different tinge of it, given I'm not a CTI analyst, so I can't I can't speak to that part. But I say like a slightly different just because of like the active the war. It's not really like there's like an active occupation going on, right? So it's really a direct support to their military operations. And also, I wanted to shout out the just a quote that they posted, the group posted on their Telegram, just to like show you how like charged everything is. The quote is, they stated that their entire infrastructure is destroyed. There's nothing left alive there. Now let them try to rebuild everything. They have as much chance as Russia is to have an easy life. And given that's translated from Ukrainian, but those are some pretty strong words. And I think like really highlights the level of passion that like we've seen from Ukraine and their people. They're really good at charging things up and getting people hyped up pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, the commitment is, I mean, it's life and death for people in Ukraine, look, quite literally, you know, right now. Mm-hmm. So you can see that these group of hackers are doing, I suppose, in their minds, whatever they can to support the war effort. I was doing a little bit of reading on the group earlier, and I didn't realize that they were the protagonist behind the Dumps Forum, which listeners might remember we talked about in the past. So this was a Ukrainian origin forum specifically created for coordination and training of new hacktivists targeting Russia, so only targeting Russian and Belarusian entities. And this particular group were behind that. And I think what was really interesting when we saw this is just we hadn't really seen that level of coordination and like training new members on a. We've seen Anonymous, which is like highly, I guess, coordinated in a way, but not backed by state policy, which obviously we saw with Ukraine. The IT of Army of Ukraine, as a defense minister coined it, you know, calling for the international community to support them in what they're doing in defending the country against you know, Russia's war of aggression. So I just thought that was really interesting as well to call out. Another very obvious question to you both is, you know, what might have been the motivation behind the timing of the attack? You know, I guess there's something really obvious going on the battlefield right now, but what do you think, you know, was behind this timing?
I mean, obviously the spring offensive comes to mind. You know, it's hard to say, particularly, you know, in this industry, I have a hard time believing in coincidences. If something starts to line up, it's I have to basically disprove that in my mind. But with that also being said, we also know that You know, typically, if you are conducting offensive operations, timing isn't something you're necessarily guaranteed, and oftentimes you take what's given to you. So if this was the, you know, the result of a compromised account or email account, which moved, let them, you know, make configuration changes or laterally move, et cetera, it could have been that they just attempted that, you know, once they had that access and confirmed the privilege they needed, they just immediately conducted that operation to prevent losing that access. You know, we see threat actors do this all the time with phishing campaigns. So, you know, it's, well, I'd like to say spring offensive. Like I said, I don't really believe in coincidences, but at the same time, the opportunistic goes both ways in terms of both, you know, e-crime and also offensive operations in this aspect.
I was just going to agree with Colin. Depending on like what method that they used for that initial access, I think timing is definitely not always up to the attacker, but it is something that's like taken into consideration pretty heavily. But yeah, I definitely agree.
Good stuff. Yeah, I saw that obviously this happened just right on the prelude of what was going down on the ground. And I drew the most obvious conclusion, which was, oh, this is, you know, quite clearly coordinated to time with that spring offensive, this well-publicized spring offensive. And of course, as we just commented, you know, these groups, even though they are hacktivists in the loosest general kind of way, there is that kind of undertone of state backing to what they're doing and coordination of their activities. So that would be the conclusion that I would draw. But yeah, you're right. It absolutely could just be an opportunistic thing, or they're about to lose an access. So let's take advantage of it as much as possible. Excellent. Thank you very much to both of you for contributing today. I really enjoyed this podcast. I'll quickly end by just again mentioning the blog we put out on the activity conducted by Klopp. That covers what we know so far about this incident in exploiting this MoveIt vulnerability, and this of the victims that have been named onto Klopp's data leak site. So I think there's 27 so far. And of course, we also cover what you need to do going forwards. That's it for this week. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.